The problem at the moment in our region is too much sun and lots of heat with it. We'll get quite a contrast 3 weeks from today, almost exactly 3 weeks from today, even in time. That's when an eclipse darkens the skies over the country in a path of totality where the moon completely blocks the sun, running from the northern Oregon coast to the South Carolina coast. That path leads a lot of people to call this the American eclipse, but the name has been applied before. In 1878, a total eclipse on a different path got the same name, and it's that event that David Baron covers in his book, American Eclipse, a nation's epic race to catch the shadow of the moon and win the glory of the world. David Baron's name might sound familiar to you. He's a former science correspondent for NPR and the former science editor for the public radio show The World. He's been chasing eclipses for nearly 20 years. David Baron, pleasure to have you on The Exchange.
Thanks so much, Jeffrey.
So this makes you an umbrophile. How many eclipses have you seen?
So I've seen 5 total solar eclipses. My first was in 1998 in Aruba, and it was truly a life-changing experience. It was just the most glorious thing I had ever experienced. And so I now, every couple of years, head off to wherever the moon's shadow will fall to experience that again. And luckily, coming up 3 weeks from now, I don't have to go very far. I'm in Colorado, but the total eclipse will cross Wyoming.
Oh, excellent. So you just got it. Well, you're going to head for the same place roughly where a lot of people went during the first American eclipse.
That's right. A lot of folks did go to Wyoming, and also that eclipse in 1878 came over Colorado as well. And in fact, I will be in the very area where the two eclipses intersected, which is up around Yellowstone National Park and Grand Teton in Jackson.
Give us a sense, for those of us who haven't been in total eclipses, and we're going to get close in our region, but not quite to totality, because that'll be a little further north through Salem. What was it that was a life-changing event for you that first time, and have you noticed different things on the 4 subsequent times?
Yeah, so a total solar eclipse is just unlike anything else you've ever experienced. It is the best I can say is, it's like being transported to another planet, because for all of those 2 or 3 minutes when the sun actually gets blotted out in the middle of the day, you see a sky like none you have ever seen before. You have this twilight in the middle of the day where bright stars and planets come out, but most dramatically, you see a sun you've never seen before. So the great paradox of a total eclipse is it's only when the sun is completely blocked by the moon that you actually can look at the sun with the naked eye. That is the only time it is safe. It won't be safe in southern Oregon, but in the part of Oregon where the total eclipse is, during totality, it is safe with the naked eye to look at the sun. And you'll see the sun's outer atmosphere, which looks like a wreath kind of woven from silvery thread that hangs out there in space and shimmers, and it is just spectacular. And basically what you're doing is you're looking toward the center of the solar system, seeing the sun and the planets together. And as I say, it's as if you've been transported elsewhere to some alien world, and you're looking at a sky you've never seen before.
So you actually take the glasses off for a couple of seconds there.
Now, I want to be very clear here. Mm-hmm. So during the partial eclipse, which is for most of North America, all you will get is a partial eclipse, and that's true in southern Oregon and northern California. It will only be a partial eclipse, and there you must protect your eyes at all times. But if you're in the path of the total eclipse, for the period when it's total, which lasts as much as 2 minutes 40 seconds, for this eclipse, during that period and that period alone, you can look and you should look with the naked eye. So in the areas where it'll be a partial eclipse, it will be very interesting. You'll see the sun turn into a thin crescent, and again, you have to look at it with proper eye protection. But it's a fundamentally different experience in the path of totality, and I am urging as many people as possible, if at all possible, on Monday, August 21st, get yourself to the path of the total eclipse.
I don't know if you've heard the projections. Oregon is a state of not quite 4 million people, and the state is expecting up to 1 million people to show up for it.
Yeah, and it's the same all across the path of totality from Oregon to South Carolina. You've got towns and cities and states that are expecting to be completely inundated. I mean, I expect that Wyoming, in fact, will have more people within its borders on August 21st than it has ever had in history.
That's entirely possible. So let's go back in history, because this 1878 American eclipse, I mean, by this point in history, we were kind of past the days of thinking the world was ending, weren't we?
Yes, for the most part, although I do open my book with what happened in Texas, where, so for the most part, people knew that the eclipse was coming, and they were excited that the eclipse was coming, and they knew that it was nothing more than the moon passing between us and the sun. But there were in parts of Texas, people had not gotten word. And you can imagine being out in your farm field on a July afternoon when suddenly it goes dark, and they looked up in the heavens, and instead of seeing the sun, they saw this golden crown shimmering overhead. Well, a lot of these folks in Texas who were quite religious were absolutely convinced that this was Jesus returning, and it was Judgment Day. And they fell to their knees in prayer, and they ran to church, and they did think it was the end of the world. They thought that the apocalypse was coming, and unfortunately, one father took this to an extreme and decided he wasn't going to wait for the apocalypse. He took a hatchet, killed his young son, then took a razor and sliced his own neck so that they would get to the other side as quickly as possible. And that was 1878. But for the most part, people did not react that way. They thought this was a great spectacle, and it was a chance for scientists to do some important astronomical work.
Yeah, that was Ephraim Miller in Texas you're talking about, wasn't it?
Correct.
Yeah, so this is a period in history when people were starting to predict that Jesus was coming a few times, and had since, I guess, the 1830s, during the Second Great Awakening?
Well, there were a lot of dates that were projected for when Jesus was coming back, and so it wasn't a great surprise that people would think that was happening in 1878.
All right, we'll talk about the American Eclipse of 1878 further with David Barron, the author of a book by that title, subtitled A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World. Thomas Edison, among the people who headed west to catch a glimpse of the eclipse as it passed over the American landmass on a rather different path. We'll talk about the path and the people and much more as we return to David Barron and American Eclipse here on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. On the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is David Barron, the former science correspondent for NPR and former science editor for The World, also heard here on the News and Information Service. He is the author of a book about the last American eclipse in 1878. It crossed the entire North American landmass. His book is called American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World. You can join our conversation on the exchange about that eclipse. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. David, can you give us a little sketch of that period in American history? We were definitely growing by leaps and bounds at this point.
Right. So 1878, of course, we had just 2 years earlier celebrated our 100th birthday. We were an adolescent country. We were just kind of just emerging on the global stage, and we were being taken very seriously as an economic power. But the United States was not taken seriously when it came to intellect. You know, Europe was the clear center of Western culture. That's where most of the respectable literature and art and music came from, and Europe was the center of science. And in fact, there were Europeans who thought that the United States would never compete in science, that this democratic, egalitarian country just would never embrace higher learning and science as something that it would do. But there was a small group of American scientists who were determined to show the world that we could compete in science. And that's what I found so interesting about the eclipse of 1878, is this was their opportunity and our country's opportunity to show that we could take on Europe in science.
What was the path? I mean, we're talking about the eclipse this year, which Oregon through South Carolina, right across the middle of the country, in fact, right over the Oregon and Missouri state capitals, I notice. Where did the American eclipse of 1878 cross?
Right. So that one went more north-south. It went from Montana Territory down to Texas. It kind of went right down the spine of the Rockies. So it crossed over Yellowstone National Park, across the Transcontinental Railroad in southern Wyoming, went over Denver and Colorado Springs, and then over Dallas before it went down to the Gulf of Mexico.
And as you mentioned, a chance for American scientists to show off their stuff. There had been a centennial exhibition 2 years earlier, and you give us a pretty good description of this in Philadelphia. And it's there that we meet James Craig Watson. Who was he?
So James Craig Watson was an eminent astronomer. He taught astronomy at the University of Michigan. And his claim to fame was that he, in fact, was known in that era as a planet hunter. You see, back in the 19th century, asteroids, which of course are small rocky bodies, they were considered planets. They were called minor planets, but they got names just like the major planets, and not very many of them had been found. And finding asteroids, finding minor planets, was a big deal. Well, James Craig Watson had a knack for finding asteroids. And he, in 1878, came out to Wyoming looking for a major planet, a planet called Vulcan, which was thought to exist between Mercury and the Sun. No one had ever reliably seen Vulcan because it's so close to the Sun. Of course, it would never be in the sky at night, and you couldn't see it in the daytime. However, during a total eclipse, when the Moon completely blocks the Sun, you should be able to see what's right around the Sun, and James Craig Watson was determined to find this hypothetical planet, Vulcan.
What were the things that he thought made it possible that Vulcan was there?
I mean, yeah, so many astronomers believed that Vulcan existed, and the reason is that Mercury's orbit didn't quite fit the calculations based on Newtonian mechanics. So back by the mid-19th century, astronomers were able to predict and calculate the paths of planets with tremendous precision. But Mercury didn't quite behave the way it was supposed to. And so the best explanation they could come up with was that something was disturbing Mercury's orbit, and that something, they thought, was a planet, or maybe several planets, that orbited closer to the Sun than Mercury. And as I say, it would be a very hard thing to see this planet, which they gave the name Vulcan, but many believed it really did exist, and James Craig Watson was determined to find it.
David Barron, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is American Eclipse, about the eclipse of 1878, a nation's epic race to catch the shadow of the moon and win the glory of the world. James Craig Watson sounds like he didn't inspire a lot of love in other people. You describe him as a corpulent narcissist. Ouch.
Yeah, I have to say, so I got to know a lot of the scientists of that era. I mean, I was reading their diaries and letters and scientific reports, and for the most part, I really enjoyed spending time with them. James Craig Watson, I have to say, was not a great human being. He didn't treat his wife very well. He had a huge ego, but he was a very accomplished man. However, I mean, his ego ended up being his downfall because he was so convinced of his own brilliance that I don't want to give too much of the story away, but in 1878, he thought he found Vulcan, and in fact, that was the big headline out of the eclipse of 1878, that an American astronomer, James Craig Watson, found the planet Vulcan. Now, it won't surprise you that, of course, he was wrong, but in his efforts to prove that, in fact, he'd been right, he quite literally worked himself to death 2 years later because he couldn't accept there was any chance that he'd been wrong.
He should have at least gotten a writing credit on Star Trek.
That's exactly right.
For talking about Vulcan years before anybody else did. We do follow James Craig Watson through the book. We also follow Thomas Edison through the book. And so what inventions was he known for at that time?
Yeah, as much as I have to say, I don't think I would have enjoyed getting to know James Craig Watson. I really enjoyed getting to know this young Thomas Edison. So in 1878, he was 31 years old. He had been quite an accomplished inventor, but really he was certainly not a household name until just a few months before the eclipse of 1878. This was the period when Edison suddenly was launched to stardom. And what made his name with the general public was the phonograph. It was in late 1877 that he came up with a way to record and play back sound at a time when that was considered to be impossible. No one ever thought you could actually record and play back sound. And so the phonograph, he became a true global celebrity. And so in 1878, when he decided he was going to go west, with a new invention he'd come up with for studying the eclipsed sun called the tizimeter, which was going to be bigger than the phonograph, some said. He was trailed by reporters. They were following him out to Wyoming and interviewing him all across the way to find out what the great genius, what the wizard of Menlo Park, New Jersey, was up to.
He had a bit of a chip on his shoulder at the time, it sounds like. What had happened to produce that chip?
Yeah, so Edison, I found it really interesting to study Edison at this point in his life because, of course, it wasn't much later that Edison became an even bigger celebrity with the invention of his light bulb. And most of the biographies that have been written about Edison come from later in his life, at a time when Edison was quite adamant that he was not a scientist. Edison himself said he was an inventor. He was not a scientist. In fact, he was quite disdainful of academic scientists who he thought just had their heads in the clouds and didn't really understand how the actual world worked. But that's not true of the younger Thomas Edison. Edison, when he went to Wyoming in 1878, respected academic scientists and kind of wanted to be one. And in fact, and this gets to what you're bringing up, a few years earlier, he, in an attempt to show that he actually was a physicist, not just an inventor, he thought he discovered a new fundamental force of nature. He called it the etheric force that was different from electricity and magnetism. And he announced to the newspapers that he had discovered a new fundamental force of nature. Well, the academic scientists very quickly decided that he was wrong, and he was ridiculed for it. And so in 1878, a few years after that, Edison, trying to restore his honor and trying to show that he was a scientist, was going to do some astronomical research during the eclipse with this invention he'd come up with called the tizimeter.
Was the etheric force the force that we're actually using right now to communicate with thousands of people?
Well, the etheric force, right, it's a good point you bring up. So Edison misunderstood what was going on. Actually, what he had discovered were radio waves. So radio waves are just another manifestation of electromagnetism. So it was not a new fundamental force. However, it was something that he didn't understand. And it wasn't until later that it turned out what he had discovered were radio waves. And so, yes, that's what we're using to communicate right now.
David Barron is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's a former science correspondent for NPR and the former science editor for the public radio show The World. He is an umbrophile. He has seen 5 total eclipses now, number 6 coming up in 3 weeks. His book is American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. I do see a call waiting. We'll get to that in a moment. And an email can come to jx@jeffnet.org. So I want to bring in the third main character, though. This is a bit of a surprise, Mariah Mitchell.
Yes. So, again, there were dozens of scientists who traveled out to the West for the eclipse of 1878, but I decided to focus primarily on 3 of them. So James Craig Watson, Thomas Edison, and the third, Mariah Mitchell, was by far the most famous female scientist in America in the 19th century, at a time when, of course, there were not very many working female scientists in America. She was an astronomer. She taught at Vassar College, which at the time was a new all-women's college in upstate New York. And she was also a staunch proponent for women's higher education and women in science. And so in 1878, when dozens of men were preparing eclipse expeditions out to Wyoming and Colorado and Texas, and they were receiving support from the federal government in terms of logistical support and funding, she was excluded. But she decided to take it upon herself to put together an all-female expedition to Denver, which was both a scientific expedition and a kind of a bit of political theater to show to the American public that women could be scientists and to open their eyes to what women could do.
You point out that it wasn't just a matter of being excluded from other scientific teams, but Mariah Mitchell, as you point out, tussled with the administration at Vassar about, and this is a women's college, getting them to pay the women professors as much as the men professors. But it does get worse. I mean, what was the general attitude toward educating women at that moment in history, David?
Yeah, so I know to modern ears it sounds like an exaggeration and completely ridiculous, but I tell you, this was taken seriously. In the 1870s, there was a theory that was taken seriously that higher education could ruin a girl's health. And this was an idea that was proposed by a Harvard doctor who in 1873 came out with a book called Sex and Education, where he argued that, and he had case studies that he claimed proved that this was true, that if a young woman used her brain too much, that sapped energy from other parts of her maturing body, including her reproductive organs. And so he claimed that higher education could turn female college students into these sterile, masculine invalids. And so this is what Mariah Mitchell was up against. There was kind of this, there was this fear in the country that, that if young women, too many young women were educated, it was going to be the downfall of the race. And so what Mariah Mitchell showed in 1878 with her team going to Colorado, and I have this wonderful photograph in the in my book of the Vassar College Eclipse Party in Colorado, these women in Victorian dresses sitting beside their telescopes, and here was Mariah Mitchell's chance to show that women could be smart and educated and scientifically minded and healthy enough to travel out to the Wild West on their own and still feminine, which was considered important in that era. And so, you know, she accomplished what she wanted to show that this Dr. Clark's book was ridiculous.
And we are talking again about David Barron's book, American Eclipse, here on the Jefferson Exchange. Let's take a call from John in Southern Oregon. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hey, nice to talk to you.
Good to talk to you. What's up?
Hey, I just have a question for the doctor. So I grew up in the very northeast corner of Oregon. I was in high school. I think it was 70, probably 79 this happened. And there is what I remember as a total eclipse. It's right during the middle of the day. We all went outside. It got all dark. Roosters crowed. But it seemed like there was a lot less fanfare at that time than there is now, maybe because of communications and such. And I'm just curious if you know of this eclipse, and if this was the same sort of total eclipse that we're having right now, because it seems that I remember that being like that, and I'll just take my answer off the air, and thanks a lot.
All right, thank you for that, John. Appreciate it.
Yes, John remembers correctly. The date was February 26, 1979, and that was the last time that a total solar eclipse crossed any part of the continental United States. It went from Oregon and southern Washington across Idaho and then up to Montana and North Dakota before going up into Canada. So the eclipse this year is a much bigger deal for several reasons. One is this is the first, the one on August 21st of this year, is the first total solar eclipse to cross the United States coast to coast in 99 years. The last one was in 1918. And of course, we do now with our, compared to 1918, certainly with our interstate highways and our jet travel and the internet. I mean, the eclipse this year will be clearly the most most witnessed total solar eclipse in U.S. history. So millions and millions of people will see the one this year. The one in 1979 was great for the Pacific Northwest, but the rest of the country was excluded.
Well, thanks to John for educating us on that. And I'm reading off of Wikipedia just now that the path of totality passed over Portland in the early morning, but it was cloudy.
That's right. And that was the other thing. A lot of people did miss it that year because it was cloudy along much of the path.
So I guess I didn't realize the regularity of eclipses, both lunar and solar. How often do they happen, David?
So, all right. So, well, lunar eclipses happen several times a year. Solar eclipses can happen a few times a year, that is, partial solar eclipses. However, a total solar eclipse is an exceedingly rare event for any given point on Earth. So I'll say this two separate ways. So if you wait for a total solar eclipse to come to you, you're going to have to wait probably a very long time, because any given point on Earth experiences a total eclipse about once every 400 years. However, about every 18 months, there is a total solar eclipse somewhere on the planet. It's, along a very narrow, long path called the path of totality. So if you're willing to travel, you could see total eclipses, as I have, a number of times in your life. However, they usually go very inconvenient places. They go across the middle of the Pacific, or they cross equatorial Africa or Antarctica. For a total eclipse to come near you is a pretty rare event. And as I say, it's been 38 years since a total eclipse crossed any part of the continental United States, and 99 years since one crossed the breadth of the country.
So a pause here just to ask about knowledge of the solar system generally in 1878. I mean, this is, what, 50 years plus before the discovery of Pluto. So how much did we know, and how much was wild speculation?
Well, so, I mean, in terms of the solar system, we were still figuring out about the planets. And as I said earlier, of course, there was this widespread belief that Mercury wasn't the closest planet to the sun and that Vulcan existed. But also beyond that, the sun itself was a great mystery. Where all that, you know, what was the source of all that fire in the sky? That was one of the things that the scientists were trying to figure out during the eclipse.
Much more to talk about with David Barron. His book is about America. It is called American Eclipse, but not about this year's. It's about the one in 1878, subtitled The Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World. He focuses on three notable figures in particular: James Craig Watson, the male astronomer, Mariah Mitchell, the female astronomer, and Thomas Edison, all of whom headed to Wyoming to see what was going on with the total eclipse. We'll come back and talk more about the circumstances of that eclipse and the discoveries therefrom and how some of these characters interacted when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to David Barron, a former science correspondent for NPR, the former science editor for another public radio show, The World. He's been chasing eclipses for nearly 20 years, considers himself an umbrophile. Total eclipse number 6 will be the one that passes over Oregon on August 21st, 3 weeks from today. His book about an earlier American eclipse in 1878 is called, not surprisingly, American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. I want to come back to Thomas Edison because he had a number of inventions that were quite durable, like the phonograph and the light bulb, but he had others that didn't last so long, like the letter stenciler and the phono motor. So, I mean, not like Edison cranked out all completely useful inventions. I have to wonder, and you could bring it up in the book, did Edison and P.T. Barnum ever meet, or were they just sort of distant peas in a pod?
That's a good point. I don't know if they had met, when the phonograph came out, as I mentioned in my book, P.T. Barnum talked about teaming up with Edison because the phonograph was actually seen as a device for entertainment, and for a while, people would pay to go see a performance of the phonograph, a demonstration. And so P.T. Barnum, who of course was into entertainment, talked about teaming up with Edison, and Edison decided wisely to avoid Barnum because, Edison was trying to prove himself a legitimate inventor, not someone who promoted flim-flam like P.T. Barnum.
You mentioned the path of totality, very different from this year's coast-to-coast eclipse. I mean, it went from the Canadian border in the Montana Territory into the Gulf of Mexico at Texas. So were a lot of people clustering in the same place? I mean, it sounds like a lot of people were heading for Colorado and Wyoming.
Yeah, so, at that time, railroad travel was pretty reliable out to the west, and so people generally went where the railroads went. And so that meant Denver. Denver was the largest city in the United States in the path of totality, and that's where most tourists went, but Colorado Springs was in the path. A number of the scientists chose to set up their equipment in Wyoming, right where the Transcontinental Railroad intersected with the Path of Totality, which was in southern Wyoming. And so there were three separate stations right along the Transcontinental Railroad, and I mean right along it, like right beside the railroad tracks is where they set up their telescopes.
I can imagine that was a pretty grueling journey in those days, particularly with the people coming from the East Coast like Mariah Mitchell. And in fact, I understand she had some complications as well, not just with the fact that we were talking slow steam trains and no air conditioning, but a couple of rival railroads.
Right. So, to go from the East Coast out to the West meant transferring from railroad to railroad. And you know, these railroad companies would sometimes get into what were called railroad wars, because they were competing often for customers and actually competing to build railroads over the same terrain. And she unfortunately found herself trapped between two railroad companies that were fighting. And although she was eventually able to transfer herself and her companions from one train to another, her bags didn't make the connection, and she ended up in Denver with her telescope parts stuck in Pueblo, Colorado, because of the railroad war. And she frantically had to find a way to get her telescope parts to her in Denver before the eclipse.
Wow, she was ahead of her time in so many ways, arriving without her luggage. I mean, that's such a modern story. So as much as the scientists of that time, David, talked about wanting to have this total solar eclipse so they could look at the atmosphere of the sun itself, is it safe to assume that the coronagraph, which actually does block out the view of the sun, had not been invented yet?
Well, they had ways, by 1878, there were ways to look at the corona in some frequencies of light without an eclipse. But if you wanted to really see the corona, you needed to wait for a total solar eclipse. And so, and at the corona at that time, so just to, as you say, the corona, which is what people on August 21st who go in the path of totality, if they're lucky to have clear skies, it's what they will see when the moon blocks the sun. It is just, we know today it's the sun's outer atmosphere, but back then it was a mystery what it was, because it's not just some ring or halo of light. It has structure to it. It looks like it's made out of strands of silk, and it's actually shaped by the magnetic field of the sun. It's a fascinating thing to look at. Well, back then they didn't know what it was. And so during a total eclipse, it was a rare opportunity to study it with their telescopes and spectroscopes and polariscopes, these various bits of equipment, to figure out, based on the light coming off the corona, what it was made up of.
Let's take another call here. We have Mark in Medford on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with David Barron, the author of American Eclipse.
Hi, is this...
That's you.
My name is Mark, and I happen to be working in Lake Tahoe, at Harrah's in their main casino showroom in 1979. John Denver was playing in the showroom at that time, and he related a story where he took his private jet along with some very close friends and flew to Washington to witness that eclipse.
Mm-hmm.
And he was relating that when he was flying his jet, it looked like a black flashlight on the Earth as it was moving across the Earth, because he had a perspective of seeing it from the jet, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And then he had his pilot fly into the darkness of the eclipse. So in one moment they were in the light, and the next they were in the dark. And then he had his pilot fly where he put the jet, where on the right side of the jet wing you could look out and it would be light. And on the left side, it would be dark. And he related that story that night after he witnessed that whole thing. And he related that night in the show.
Wow, that's a pretty that's an interesting story. And it's some pretty slick flying. And there's a great animation, David, that I'm looking at on the Wikipedia site for the solar eclipse of February 26, 1979, that shows the shadow of the moon moving across the Earth. It's really something to see, isn't it? And it sounds like John Denver's pilot was pretty savvy to know how to handle that.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you, Mark, for that story. So that is one of the most awesome things one can see during a total eclipse. There are many things that one can gawk at, and that is to actually see the shadow of the moon as this black curtain from outer space. And I describe in my book the folks in 1878 who were on top of Pike's Peak at 14,000 feet. So they weren't in an airplane, but they were high on a mountain, and that's exactly what they saw. They could look up to the northwest and see, this shaft of darkness coming down into the atmosphere, moving toward them at 2,000 miles an hour, and they could actually see the distant peaks that were still in sunlight popping out of sight as this black curtain moved in toward them. And so I actually, on August 21st, I'm going to be on a mountaintop in Wyoming hoping to get that same view. But that's what John Denver saw. He actually saw the moon's shadow itself. And if you're up above, you can see it as a dark circle zooming across the landscape.
But you have to be how high to be able to see that effect?
Well, good question. I mean, even if you're on a flat plain or if you're on the coast of Oregon, if you have clear skies, you might be able to see that shaft coming down a black from outer space. But if you're up high, you can actually see the dark circle on the ground below. And I'll say that last year, so there was a total eclipse that in 2016 crossed the Pacific, and I was in Indonesia for that one. But there was an Alaska Airlines flight that went from Anchorage to Honolulu that crossed into the path of the moon's shadow. And there's a wonderful YouTube video that shows what it looked like from above. And if you do a Google search on Alaska Airlines Eclipse 2016, you'll find it. But there's an eclipse chaser I know named Mike Kentrianakis who filmed it with his iPhone. And his reaction is just priceless to seeing the moon's shadow from above.
Wow, that sounds amazing. I want to come back to the 1878 American eclipse, because it wasn't just American scientists. I mean, how far and wide did scientists come from overseas, and were there some big names in that flock?
Yeah, good point. So as I said earlier, this was America's chance to show what we could do in science. Right here was an eclipse in our own backyard, but this was a period in general when total eclipses were very important and when scientists chased them all over the world. So in 1870 there was a total eclipse that went over the Mediterranean, and in 1868 there was one that went over India, and scientists went to those. So this one was in our backyard, and European scientists came over here to witness it. So there were a number of particularly British astronomers who came here. And one of the most prominent was a man named Norman Lockyer, who actually is the man who first discovered the element helium, and he gave it the name helium, and he found it in the sun decades before it was ever found on Earth. So Norman Lockyer was here. He was here with Thomas Edison. And Lockyer was a highly influential man because he, besides being an astronomer, was the founding editor of the British scientific journal Nature, which, of course, remains one of the most important scientific journals in the world. And so Lockyer was writing about Edison and what he saw of the other American astronomers and praising them. And in this way, you know, the eclipse of 1878 really did raise the profile of American science on the global stage, in part because of Norman Lockyer and what he witnessed and what he said in his own journal.
The description of the hours before the eclipse, it sounds almost like the bride's ready room before a wedding. I mean, what kinds of emotions were these guys going through?
Oh, it's true today as well for astronomers who still conduct studies during a total eclipse. There's just tremendous nervousness about, you know, you've got 2 or 3 minutes to conduct your studies. So they have spent, first of all, they've spent years anticipating the event, months preparing for it, often days or weeks at that point, traveling to the site and setting up their equipment. And they're practicing and practicing and practicing, and it could all be ruined by a single cloud floating by at the wrong time. So there's just tremendous nervousness looking at the skies, making sure the equipment's working right, making sure that they have everything timed down to the second how they're going to spend totality. So there was tremendous, tremendous stress leading up to the total eclipse.
You certainly have a benefit in writing this book and that you have seen now 5 total eclipses yourself. And so the words that you use to describe the totality that they saw clearly come from your own experience. It's not utter darkness. It's something quite else.
It's more like a twilight. And frankly, having seen 5 total eclipses, they're all different. The sky colors are somewhat different. Some get really dark. Some get less dark. It depends on how much moisture is in the atmosphere, the angle at which the moon's shadow is coming in. But it's certainly not like midnight. It is more like twilight, maybe like a half hour after sunset. And actually, one of the more remarkable things to see during a total eclipse is you'll see twilight overhead, but it looks like sunset or sunrise on the horizon all around you, 360 degrees. So it's a very, very bizarre sky, and it is, it's hard to describe, and as you say, having witnessed five myself, that helped me in trying to describe what the scientists saw in 1878.
So, David, by the time of the 1878 American eclipse, photography had been around for a few decades. I can't say that it advanced terribly far, but, I mean, I see photos in the book and elsewhere of people waiting, but I don't see the eclipse itself. Did anybody get photographs of it?
Yes, they did, but they're not terribly exciting photographs because the solar corona is a really difficult thing to photograph. It goes from extremely bright on the inner part to extremely dim on the outer reaches. And so what the eye sees is this marvelously textured ring in the sky. But photographs of that era just show it as a simple halo. It's not very interesting. And it's really, today with modern digital photography and digital processing techniques, we're able to create things that look much more like what the naked eye sees during totality.
You already mentioned that the three main characters we're following in the book, James Craig Watson, Mariah Mitchell, and Thomas Edison, that Watson still thought that he discovered Vulcan, which turned out not to be true. Were there any revelations and bumping up in prestige for either Edison or Mariah Mitchell?
Well, so, you know, again, for a while, it looked like James Craig Watson was right. And so he was hailed as you know, the great American hero of the eclipse of 1878, bringing all this pride to the country for having discovered the planet. And he got himself a new job. He went from the University of Michigan to the University of Wisconsin, who wooed him away with more money and a larger telescope. And Edison, it brought great prestige to Edison as well. And I know we're running out of time, but I will say that Edison going west for the eclipse of 1878 helped him in his efforts to construct the light bulb the year after that.
Well, certainly something we need during an eclipse then, right?
Yeah, right.
To keep things light. David Barron is our guest on The Exchange. His book is American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World. David, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Jeffrey. I wish you clear skies on August 21st.